You are listening to Angry Indian Radio, the podcast of the Aboriginal Press News Service.
Find us on the web, ang-newswire.blogspot.com.
Well, Mr. President, you've been a governor and a president, so you have a unique experience looking at it from two directions. What do you think tribal sovereignty means in the 21st century? And how do we resolve conflicts between tribes and the federal and state governments?
Yeah. Tribal sovereignty means that. It's sovereign. You've been given sovereignty and you're viewed as a sovereign entity. Okay. And therefore, the relationship between the federal government and tribes is one between sovereign entities.
Angry Indian Radio. You are listening to the Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Stand up and fight for Indigenous rights.
Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
This is Indian land! Indian land! Indian land! Indian land! You guys have no jurisdiction here.
You are listening to the Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Real talk for the fourth world.
Radio Intelligente Indigena.
Radio Intelligente Indigena.
Who are you? You don't know. Don't tell me Negro, that's nothing. What were you before the white man named you a Negro? And where were you? And what did you have? What was yours? And how did he take it? What gun did you see? Where is your history? How did the man wipe out your history? What did the man do to make you as dumb as you are right now?
Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
All Indians, all over the land, all saying the same thing. This is our homeland. This is our birthright. They don't want any white man comes in here and tell us that you have to divide this up this way or that way. The white man doesn't own this land. Just because he has a gun, he said, I took your land.
Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Transmitting from within the occupied Aboriginal territories of North America to the people of the Fourth World and all ships at sea. This is Radio Intelligente Indigena.
Internet radio for smart Aboriginal.
Este es Aborigen Inteligente de Radio.
This is Radio Inteligente de Indigena.
Indian, run their dadgum, dad-blasted sheep over our land just like they owned it.
Why don't they stay on the reservation where they belong?
Este es Aborigen Inteligente de Radio.
Internet radio for smart Aboriginal.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, transmitting to the people of the Fourth World from within occupied North America. This is Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Salutation and peace to all Aboriginal human beings resident on the physical plane. I'm your host, Angry Indian, Editor-in-Chief of the Aboriginal Press News Service, blogging to the Fourth World from aboriginalpressnews.tumblr.com and aboriginalpress.wordpress.com and ang-newswire.blogspot.com, and you have tuned in to Indigenous news and thought and analyses concerning the issues that matter to Aboriginal peoples and other communities across the world living under imperial, theological, racist, neo-classist, neo-colonialist, neo-liberal, and neo-fascist control. I wish you all welcome to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Welcome along. Shout out to the gods and earths and peace to the original family of this time of strife and struggle. This is the Angry Indian, and you are listening to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Today we have an interview. It's a little different than what we've done. It's almost a monologue, actually. But this was an interview with Shannon Venn. Some of you might remember her. She's really been in the international media in terms of addressing Indigenous issues on a global scale. in international courts. And, you know, it's pretty serious. She's listed at nativeoffice.com. This is coming from the Greenfield Review Press. As a Canadian Cree, but through marriage, she's a citizen of the Blood Tribe in Treaty 7. She has played an active role in the national and international struggles of many indigenous peoples, including the Lupicon Cree and the Dene Nation. Sharon has a Master's of Law degree from the University of Alberta and is presently a doctoral candidate writing a thesis on treaty rights of indigenous peoples and international law. Now, she was being interviewed by Jean-Paul Montano. You can find him at JP Montano on Twitter. He's a second language speaker of his particular indigenous language, and I don't want to embarrass myself or him by trying to pronounce it, so I'm not going to try. Participating in a rebuilding that has made necessary in part by the Indian Boarding Residential School Systems. You can find his work at BarbaraNolan.com. As I mentioned, he's a member of the Aboriginal News Group, and he has quite a lot to say out there if you look. I really think you need to check out his Twitter feed. It's extremely important. And this is his rather long and very passionate and personal interview with Ms. Sharon Venn. This is Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Internet radio for smart aboriginals.
I was going to start by talking about last year. I was in a conference in Australia, and there was a lot of women came to this conference, Indigenous women, and I was really interested to talk to them because, you know, of our relation as women to the land, that we are the landowners and that we have a relationship with the land. And I was wondering about the Australia, you know, the Aboriginals in Australia, which is actually not their real name, but anyway, what their relationship was. And I was curious. And so there was a number of women that were at this meeting, and we were talking about the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, and I'll get into that later. But we started talking, and they were telling me the story of what's happened to them. And in the Northern Territory of Australia, they introduced this law called the Intervention Act, where they sent the military into the communities because the people were opposing uranium mining and storage of uranium. But they used another guise. They said they weren't, you know, taking care of their children, and white women were getting beaten up by the men, and, you know, all kinds of, you know, stories in the media about how bad they were. Anyway, what the women did was they took their children, because they're the landowners, they went on the land. They just went with their kids like that. No tents, no nothing. They just went out the way they used to live. And they've been living on the land and teaching their children the way they did, and they're still out there. Anyway, this woman was talking about this, and she was talking about how important it was for them to re-educate their children. And she says to me, "I have to apologize for something." And I said, "About what?" She said, "That I have to speak to you in English." She said, "I speak 7 of my own languages, and I also speak English." She said, "And I feel bad that I speak English." I said, "Me too, I feel bad." She said, "You know, that's that baby language." She said, "That language was the last language to be created. Our language are ancient. We know everything about our land because of the language we have. Every rock, every mountain, every tree, all the animals, the bugs, everything, we know that because of our languages." She said, "And when they came over here, they started putting their names on our land, on our animals, on our trees, even on who we are." She said, "They give us English names." She said, "It's a baby language, and it's act like a spoiled child. Spoiled child, I want my way, like a temper tantrum. I put that name on that land. I put that name on that river." She said, "So we have to take back that. We have to put our names back on our land." And she says, "Because what they're doing with forcing their baby language on us is that they're alienating us from our land. Our children don't know our land." She said, "So we have to teach our children our language, because in that they'll learn who their connection to the land. As women, that's our responsibility. And it just happened that her partner was there. And he was sitting there on the side, and he said, and I'm there to make sure that that happens. I'm her protector. That's what my job is. She's the one that has to speak for the land. I'm only there to support her. And it was a really powerful statement. And I was thinking about that, because the language, they don't want us to learn our languages, because they want us to remember only their language. And that was one of the things I was talking about in the seminar this morning, or yesterday too, was I've taught in Europe, different universities. Most of the students that I encountered in those universities speak four or five languages fluently. They read in four or five languages. And I think, well, if they can do that and still maintain whoever they are, Italian or Swiss or German or Danish or Swedish, whatever language, whatever country they come from, whatever nationality they say they are, they still maintain that. They still have that identity, but they still speak all these languages. And I really thought about that. I thought, why is it like that over there? And then here they don't want us. You know, don't want us to learn our language. And to me, it relates directly to the land. They don't want us to remember the name of the hills, the mountains, the water, everything. They want us to forget that, so that we would alienate ourselves from our own land. You know, and so that's why I think, you know, language is really important. Anyway, so this lady, I had a really good conversation with her. She told me a story about these mining companies. Now they want to come and talk to her, like her and these ladies that are out in the land. So they showed up one day with their PowerPoints and laptop computers and all this stuff, and they want to have a conversation with them. But they don't have any power, because they're living in there's no electricity. So they came there and they said they wanted to meet with them, and they had this PowerPoint presentation they want to make with them. They said, no electricity. They said, well, we want to show a PowerPoint. There's no screen. They said, why don't you just sit down and tell us? And they said, where do you want us to sit? And they said, well, we're sitting on the ground. You can sit on the ground too. And she said it was so funny. You should have seen how they were trying to get on the land. She said they couldn't. They didn't know how to sit down. She said they were kind of funny. Like, she said they were all making all these gestures. Like, and she's making all this stuff. And finally got on the land. Because when I was meeting with her in this building, she told us to get out of the chairs and get on the floor. So she made us sit on the floor. And you know, I'm used to sitting, you know, on the floor. I'm used to sitting, you know, in the ground. And I don't have a problem with that. So, you know, I flopped down. But they couldn't get up. That was the funny part of it. She said they were laying on their sides and then trying to crawl around and lift themselves up. She said they had no relationship to the land. You could tell that. And she said, and they come out there and they want to talk to us about the land. They didn't even know what they're talking about. And so she told them to go away. And that's, I think, you know, what we have to do, teach our young people how much authority we have in relation to our territory. Not just, you know, reserved lands. Because we made treaty and we reserved certain lands to ourselves. We said we would share lands, but we reserved certain lands. And we have to, our young people have been, and let me even older people think that reserves are a bad thing. They think it as if it's a negative, because that's what the colonizer has led us to believe, that these are negative places. And the faster we get away from it, the better we are. You know, we somehow became civilized then or something, you know. We've moved on to some other point. But that's what they want us to do, is to walk away from our land and to walk away from our territory. So, you know, quite often I meet people and I say to them, where are you from? And they'll give me some name of a reserve, and I say, no, what's your territory? My territory? What's the name of your territory? And they don't know what the name of their territory is, but they know the name of a reserve, but they don't know the territory. And I keep saying, go back to your territory, because in that territory is everything. We need to understand where our territory is, and that's how much they have tried to separate us from that. So we need to go back to that and teach our children that, because in that confidence building, they will be able to find the identity which will keep them strong enough to survive if they leave our territory to do something. And I think that's what we have an obligation to do. And when I grew up, I was one of the first Indians in Canada to go to university. I went to university in 1970. As soon as they said we could go to university, I was in the university. But I was the only one there. You know, I looked around and I didn't see another indigenous person anywhere. But I knew where I came from. I had a strong sense of who I was. You know, I knew that. I knew the clan I came from. I knew my territory. I knew what it meant to be part of that clan. I knew. So I had this information that my grandmother gave me because she raised me. And she used to tell me to listen to her because her mind had never been touched by the white man. Because she had never been in school. She never went to the white school. She was taught by the elders. And she used to say to me, listen to me what I'm telling you, because my mind is never touched by the white man. And it was pure knowledge coming forward. And she said, there's very few of us left that haven't been touched by them. You know, and she was always correcting me. Like, I'd come home and I'd say something, and she'd look at me and she'd go, no, that's not right. It's not right what you're talking about. That's not the way we understand it. And she was always forcing me to think about what they told me and how it was being conveyed to me. She really, you know, she really enforced that on me. So even though I was in a university going to school, as you know, I was actually not being indoctrinated, I don't think. Even though, you know, I used to think I wasn't being indoctrinated, but yet she would still correct me because she could see it. And so that was... Like, when I came out of law school with my law degree, I went to stay with her. And she had this old man came and was there. I thought they were just visiting, you know, just kind of like, this old man's there. You know, where, you know, so I was taking care of them. I was cooking and cleaning up. They were talking, telling stories. And a couple of days later, she said to me, can I take the old man home? And I said, yeah, I can drive. So I drove him home. He never said nothing to me all the way, almost to his house. And then he said to me, he said, you haven't changed. And I said, what? He said, you still took care of us. You didn't say nothing. You didn't interrupt us. You didn't tell us how to think or anything like that. He said, that's good. It's good, he said. And I didn't really understand what he was talking about. Like, I sort of, you know, okay. I'm just... And afterwards, I really understood what was going on. Like, she wanted to see someone else from outside of herself to evaluate what happened to me. To see whether or not I had changed from being in law school, because they didn't know nothing about this law school, but they wanted me to go to law school. And they said that in the future I would help my people. And I didn't know why they wanted me to go to law school, but I listened to them and I went. But they didn't know what was going to happen to me. And so they wanted to check that out. And she didn't trust herself. Because she said to me afterwards, she said, because I love you, you know. And I didn't know, she said, I wanted to see what someone else thought. She said, that's what the old man was there for. And I said, so I'm okay? And she said, you're okay. She kissed me on the top of my head, told me I was a good girl. So, but we don't have enough, we don't do enough of that to our people. And, like, I see a lot of people graduated from law school now who only think about the white law. They don't think about our own legal systems. They think our writing administrative policy is draft, you know, is our law. So our young people are, you know, going into law school and they're being encouraged to go into law school, but they're not learning anything about who we are. They don't know who we are either, which is kind of sad because they have university education but don't know who we are as Indigenous peoples. And so about, I don't know, 2 or 3 weeks ago, I was invited to one of the First Nations. And they wanted me to draft a law for them. And I said, no, I won't do it. And they said, what? You know how to do it. I said, oh yeah, I know how to do it. I said, but I don't know your community. I don't know your people. How can I draft something for you? Why don't you, you know, you can ask Indian Affairs to draft it for you, do the same thing. And they said, well, you know, how do we go about it? And I said, by talking to your people. Ask them what they want in this law and write it down. If you write it down in your own language, then I'll look at it and tell you if you left out anything or what I think maybe you might think about. But I said, I won't do it for you because you have to do it yourselves. But if you, and I was just, then yesterday I was talking to a woman who is a lawyer, Indian woman, Indigenous woman. And I was telling her I did that to them. And she said, what? Why did you do that? She said, you could have had a job. And I said, no, you're looking at it the wrong way. Why would I want to do something like that so that I could have a job. That's not the way to look at it. What you have to do is try to empower people, give them the courage to draft, do their own, bring the law back from before and use it again. That's what our job should be. Not to say, oh, well, I know what you need in that law and then go ahead and do it like a job. It's not a job. And so she said, oh, I never thought of it that way. But that's what, because she had been in a system where they encourage you to do it for everybody. And that lawyers are, you know, can do this. And I remember one time an elder told me that he said that indigenous peoples going to law school are the most dangerous Indians. And I was sitting there and I said to him, why do you say that? And he said, because they go into that system. He said, they learn only the white man's law. He said, then they come back and they try to tell us, you live by this law. He said, you know that this is not right. He said, but there's not very many of you. And he said, in the future, you're going to be overtaken by these other ones. You know, he's been right. You know, he's been gone a number of years now. But I often think about what he told me and how he's seen it happening. And so, you know, we always have to be, I think, always have to question what we're learning, not just to say, oh, yeah, that's right. Because their system isn't working for them, and why should it work for us?
This is Radio Angwa Indian. Angwa Indian Radio for the Fourth World.
Hello, I'm Carol Gordon. Traditionally, Native women made all decisions regarding their reproductive health care. This was respected as women's business. Today, we are basically denied this decision-making power. It's time to take back that power of making decisions concerning our reproductive health. There is a choice we can make regarding unwanted pregnancy. Plan B is an emergency contraceptive that must be taken within 72 hours after having unprotected sexual intercourse in order for it to be effective in preventing pregnancy. Contact your local Indian Health Service facility and ask if they carry Plan B. If not, tell them to order it. Plan B is an OTC, over-the-counter contraceptive, and a prescription is not necessary. You have a legal right to access this contraceptive over-the-counter. This message is brought to you by the Native American Women's Health Education Resource Center.
I'm Dick Gregory with PETA. Martin Luther King Jr. taught me the fight against oppression is never an easy one. It's even harder if you have no voice. For animals held captive in circuses, life consists of cramped cages, shackles, and daily beatings. There is no escape. They cannot demand their freedom. Images like these bring only one word to my mind, slavery. Be an abolitionist for the animals. Please don't go to circuses. For more information, contact PETA.
757-622-PETA.
This is Noam Chomsky. Strong evidence suggests that the Bush administration launched an illegal war and lied to Congress, spied on Americans without court approval, leaked classified information, produced phony news reports, imprisoned without charge and tortured, targeted civilians and used illegal weapons. Ask your Congress member to co-sponsor an investigation.
Sponsored by AfterDowningStreet.org.
Every day, one more Aboriginal person will test positive for HIV. Some will be rejected by their family, friends, and community. They will live in isolation, their voices no longer heard. HIV/AIDS stigma and discrimination denies our people the right to protect their future. You can make a difference. Be their voice.
White society wants you to know that anti-African racial hatred is a thing of the past.
What do you think about this idea? Since we freed the slaves in 1865, don't you think the black race owes the white race reparations? I was thinking like $20,000, you know, per person. I mean, anybody that's not on welfare.
With white people showing love like this, who needs enemies? Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. The anti-colonial cure for mental slavery.
You know, there's a lot of problems in their system. Like, the whole world now is on the verge of economic collapse. And that's what the elders had predicted. They said in the future there's going to be money blowing down the streets. Nobody's not even going to stop to pick it up because it doesn't mean that. It's not going to mean anything and it won't buy nothing. So, you know, and I think we're pretty close to that day. But how many of our people are ready for that day? Because they've been thinking that that's what we needed to do, was to turn our back on the land and our resources and all the relations that we have with the animals and everything and run after something else. And that's what we need to, I think, when we talk about an education system, that's what we need to bring to our young people, that they know that they're valuable, because right now they don't see themselves in that system. And that, why do they drop out? It's not because we're dumb. I don't think we're stupid people. But you don't see anything in that system for us. Like, when I was going to school, it was my grandparents kept saying, you're doing this because in the future you're going to help. You're doing this because in the future you're going to help. And so I wasn't doing it for myself. I was doing it for the future. And that's what kept me in there, because it was not easy being in law school. I was the only Indian in the law school. And it was the most horrific experience. And many times I wanted to walk away. Many times I wanted to walk away. But I would remember what they told me. You're doing this for the future, so you just kept on going. Because it was not a system you wanted to be involved in. I could see every day how what they were doing. I could understand what they were doing, and I hated it. But I just kept on going anyway. Because it wasn't for me. And I think that a lot of our people have been moved away from that. They've been moved into this, what's good for me, rather than for the people. They don't think about the collective anymore. They only think about themselves. They've individualized themselves, and they think that's good. And in the meantime, what's going to happen to the land? They don't think about that. A lot of people can't, they don't know what to do. They don't know how to go on the land. They haven't got a clue. You know, if you put them out there on the land, they wouldn't know what to do. They wouldn't be able to make a fire. They wouldn't put up a tent. They couldn't even make a shelter, let alone kill something and eat it. They wouldn't even know what to do with that, you know? So, I was thinking about a funny story one time. We were out in the bush, and they shot some ducks, and I was plucking a duck. And there was these young people. Oh, there was like 12, 13-year-olds, 14-year-olds. They were sitting there on the rock, and they were watching me, and I was plucking this duck. And they said, how did you learn how to pluck a duck? I said, what do you mean, how did I learn how to pluck a duck? Yeah, plucking ducks since I was about 5 years old, 6 years old maybe, I don't know how old I was. I was learning how to pluck a duck, and they said, but we thought you were a lawyer. And I said, yeah, but before I was a lawyer, I was an Indian. And I learned how to pluck a duck, you know. But, you know, they thought, our young people are being told, you can do this, but you can't be both. And you can't, you know how to dry meat or pluck ducks or dry berries or, you know, tan a hide or something like that because you're a lawyer, you know. And I think we have to stop thinking like that, because we're alienating our own young people. And that's really, you know, really sad, you know. It really bothers me that our young people think that, and we need to reach out to them and try to make them understand that they are valuable. You know, that why I'm doing this work is for them and their grandchildren. And because I remember my grandfather saying something like that to me. You know, the life I lived was for you to have a future. Like, as a treaty Indian, to keep care of the land. He told me that one time, and I didn't, you know, I'm listening to him, okay. I don't know why you're telling me that, but okay, I hear it. I never forgot it, but I didn't understand it, except that I knew somehow I was valuable to him. And that gave me some confidence in myself, that a lot of, I didn't know that people weren't being told that kind of thing. I thought everybody was told these things. Like, our people my age knew those things, but I didn't know that they didn't. That was kind of shocking to me, but you know, all the people I went to school with now are not here anymore. I'm the only one left in my age group. So they, you know, for various reasons are not here with us anymore. So they, you know, because they got into drugs, they got into drinking, they got into bad relations, and they got murdered, and all kinds of things have happened to them. But it's only lately, or I guess, I don't know, not that late, but maybe 30 years, I suddenly realized that they didn't know the same things I did. And so that's when I started talking. Talking about what happened, what's going on. That's when I started, you know, teaching at universities, trying to reach out to our young people. I used to teach at law school. I used to be a tenured law professor. And I gave it up. And the reason I gave it up was because one day I was filing a court case that's very important to our people, and I went into, you have to, when you're filing it against the government, you have to serve the Department of Justice notice. So I went over to the Department of Justice with the documents to file them, and they had to, what they call, accept, receive the documents. And the woman that came out to receive them was a former student of mine in the law school, and she was working for the Department of Justice. And I thought, oh no, I have trained this woman to be a good lawyer, but she's now working against our own people. And I turned around and I thought, I gotta get the hell out of here. I gotta get out of this system, you know. So I left the tenured law professorship because of that. I just could not see myself training these young people to fight against our people. I just couldn't do it. So I walked away from that. People think I'm nuts, but anyway, I did it anyway. Because I can't, I have to live honestly with the ancestors in the future. I can't pretend it doesn't exist, you know. So that's what going to law school meant to me. Well, yesterday when I was doing the workshop, and I actually didn't refer to it today, but when I was doing the workshop yesterday, somebody asked me about an education coordinating panel or some kind of working thing that's going on. I can't remember the name of it now, but they were talking about, you know, that how did I think about that? And my comment about it was that people are going to the table, at least from our side of the table, and we don't have a clear view of what exactly our goals and objectives are and what we want to do with education. And we're, you know, thrown into a mix of with the other side, who has a very clear goal of what they want to do with us. And we needed to develop our own goals and objectives. And of course, the first comment that comes from that, when you'd say that to people, is, well, you know, where are we going to get the funding to do it? How can we, because all our funding is locked down by the government, which is what they, you know, intended to do. And I made a reference to Rigoberta Menchu Tum, who is a Mayan woman from Guatemala. And Rigoberta Menchu came to Geneva in the early 80s. During the time of the war in Guatemala, there was a big war going on with the indigenous peoples and the state, and they were, you know, killing indigenous peoples, you know. Her mother, her father, her brothers, I think most of her family were murdered by the military. Anyway, she came to Geneva, but she ended up winning the Nobel Peace Prize because despite everything that happened to her, she was constantly remembering that her ancestors, her family, talked about living in peace within her territory. And she promoted that even though she'd been through this horrific experience. And she won the Nobel Prize for peace, and she was the only indigenous person ever to win the Nobel Prize, Peace Prize. And she sits on the board of directors. She's on the board of UNESCO, which is the United Nations Education Social Committee. They're located in Paris, and their mandate is to promote education, language retention, cultural retention around the world, and they have recognized that indigenous languages are very close to extinction in many parts of the world. And so there's been a lot of promotion of indigenous languages, and they have programs to assist, you know, in that work. And so, you know, we should make use of them because we are recognized as indigenous peoples, and we've done a lot of work at the United Nations since, you know, well, majorly since 1977 when we first started really, you know, going over there and saying, you know, to Geneva and saying, we have rights as nations. And rightly, we should be before the Committee on Decolonization because we are colonized. And the only reason that we cannot appear before the Decolonization Committee is that they passed in 1962 at the General Assembly what they called the Blue Water Theory, developed by Belgium, of all people, knowing how their colonization of the Congo went. But anyway, it was another story. They passed what they called the Blue Water Theory for the Decolonization Committee, saying that if you were not colonized by people who are separated by blue water, you could not appear before the Committee for Decolonization, which means that indigenous peoples of Turtle Island or Central and South America, which we are colonized, I mean, because America is not our name. America is, you know, some Italian map maker who was drawing the map up and thought, hey, I want to be live forever. I'm going to put my name on the map. So North, Central, and South America comes from him, you know, from him. Anyway, we are not allowed to go to the Decolonization Committee, so they say. And so they, I mean, talking about states in Central and South America, United States and Canada, vested interest, so that we can't appear before the Decolonization Committee. So we had to make our own way and try to find a way through that, through Geneva. And I just wrote a paper, it's going to be published in the Fletcher's Law Journal, about how when we started in the UN in 1977, we started drafting our own declaration. Because we looked through the UN laws and all we could see was stuff that related to individual rights. And we said, no, our rights are collective. And we fought for many years over the word peoples. And because they don't want us to be recognized as peoples. Because peoples in international law are people, or they have rights to land, territory, government, laws, our own structures, you know, we have, make our own decision in relation to our future, you know, future. And so they didn't want us to be peoples. And what they wanted us to have was people without the S. Well, actually, when they first set up the working group in the 82, they said it was indigenous populations. Not even people, but populations. I used to mock that all the time. Because I'd say, you know, we're not a population of, you know, deer or trees or whatever, insects or something, you know. We are peoples, you know, and we have these rights of self-determination. And so we were drafting our own declaration up until 1985, when the UN took it over and started drafting a declaration. So from 85 to 2007, we had to try to fight to maintain our original draft. But when it hit New York, there were people that collaborated with state governments to weaken the declaration. And if you look at the declaration now, it has individuals in it. It takes the Convention on the Rights of the Child and incorporates it into it. And we had never, ever agreed to be bound by the Convention on the Rights of the Child, simply because it said that the best interest of the child will be paramount. And the problem with the best interest of the child is based on a Eurocentric value of what a child is worth, not what an indigenous nation considers to be valuable for our children. And so our values of children is not incorporated into that. So they did a lot of there was a lot of problems with the declaration. And so the UN passed it, but it's not reflective of what it should be. And so we are still working in Geneva, still working trying to find a way through this process that's been thrown in our path. But we have to continue pressing forward, because even though it's been 500 years, since more than 500 years now since Columbus has landed on our shores, as I say, lost and disorientated. He's trying to find the Orient and he got turned around. And even though that's still in place, and the papal bulls, which says we can't own our land because we're not Christian, and Steve Newcomb has done humongous amount of work in that area. I don't know if you read his book, Pagans in a Promised Land. It's a great book about, they're the pagans and they're in our land. And they say that we can't own our land because we're not Christian. That papal bull is still on the records. And in 1991, we had written to the Pope, dear Pope, can you rescind the papal bull? And they said no. The Roman Catholic Church said no. And the reason they said no was because they were celebrating 500 years of evangelism in the Americas. And I told the papal bull Nuncion, or whatever his name is, in Geneva, I said, I got news for you, Mr. Papal Bull Nuncion. I am not a Christian. I am an indigenous person believing in my own way of living. I am not a Christian. And I said, I raised my son, and he's not a Christian either. I said, so 500 years of evangelism in the Americas is a complete failure. Give it up. Walk away while you still have time. But they still hang on to that, because the problem is, if they give it up, what right does anybody, Canada, United States, have to say that they have rights to our land? They don't. They don't have rights to Turtle Island. In the United States, there was some guy named Marshall. He had his court case, Johnson v. McIntosh, and they said they came out with this idea that we were dependent domestic nations. That we were dependent domestic nations, dependent on the United States of America. That was just recently created. 1776, they created it. But the thing is, under international law, the United States does not have a right to our land and territory, because they were the colonizers. And the United Nations, it says the colonizers do not have legal rights to territory, lands, and resources. That's what they said to South Africa. And they said, you have to give the land back to the blacks. They did that in South Africa. And yet in the United States and Canada, they're not saying the same thing. But it's the same legal position. Same thing with the Palestinians in relation to Israel. The United States has a schizophrenic approach to that. They don't really want to support the Palestinians, but they want to support the Israelis, because the Israelis are in the same position as they are. They're occupying someone else's land without legal authority. So if the U.S. is too much against Israel, Israel says, well, what about what's going on in America? You're occupying the lands of indigenous peoples, and they do it. I know in the UN they've done that to the United States. They've done that to Canada, to shut them up. They don't want to say anything. So we have to keep pressing as indigenous peoples. We have to keep going there, not as Canadians or Americans, but as indigenous peoples from our own nations. I remember one time this woman from Canada, she was mad at me for something. I made some comment about Canada in the meeting, and she was really hot under the collar. And she came chasing me down the hallway and pointing her finger at me and just livid. I like to see them livid, because it means you got to them. Anyway, she got pointing her finger down, and she says to me, you travel under a Canadian passport. I said, what's the point? She said, well, you accept Canada. And I said, no, I'm just using the passport. I said, the Mossad uses your passport. What's the problem here? And so she just got so huffy, and she walked away down the hallway. She goes, whoop, like this. And I started laughing at her, because who the hell does she think she is to come and tell me, what I can do or not do? She's living in my territory, and she's using my resources, and she thinks she has a right to come and try to browbeat me? She doesn't have a right to browbeat me. She should be happy that we let her live in our territory. rather than trying to put us down. But they got real problems, you know. They got real problems. They know they're colonizers. They know they're not here. You know, at one time they were, you know, saying that, I remember one time they were saying they're going to do away with the treaties. Well, they're going to do away with your treaties. I go, good. I'm glad to hear that. Do away with the treaties. I said, because if you do away with the treaties, then we're before the decolonization committee faster than you could spit. Because then you have no legal right to be in our territory. Because that's what the International Court of Justice said in the Western Sahara. I said, so do away with the treaties. Go ahead, do away with them. Because I'm going to appear before the decolonization committee tomorrow. And I'm going to ask them to decolonize us. So go ahead. I dare you. And then they shut up. You know? Because they know that they don't have any legal authority to do what they're doing. And they're trying to browbeat us, and we can't let them browbeat us. We have to stand up for ourselves. Nobody's going to stand up for us unless we stand up for ourselves first. And that's what we were told by, you know, the president of Tanzania one time. He said, you guys stand up for yourselves, we'll be 100% behind you. But you got to stand up for yourselves first. You know, so that's what we've been trying to do. Except we have a few collaborators here and there, but, you know, what can you do about the Quislings? You know the word Quisling? During the Second World War, the Nazis occupied Norway. And when they occupied Norway, they wanted the Norwegians to vote in their own president or prime minister of Norway so that the Norwegian president, prime minister, would be working with the Nazi from Germany. And the Norwegians refused. They refused to participate in that. So the Nazis appointed a guy named Quisling as the prime minister of Norway. It's in a dictionary. You can look it up. A Quisling means somebody who works for the occupying forces against their own people. And we have a Q list out west. And every once in a while I'm on the phone talking to my friend. And I say, oh, we should add so-and-so to the Q list. I'm sure the security people are wondering, what the hell is the Q list? You know? But maybe we should take off so-and-so off the Q list because they've been doing this, that, and the other thing, you know? But, you know, we have to keep track of these people who are collaborating. And we don't say enough of that. These, you know, you're collaborating with the other side against your own people. You know? And, you know, in other times, they wouldn't see sunset. You know? So we have to call them out. We have to say, you know, you're collaborating. You know, how much are they paying you to collaborate? And we need to put it out there. Because otherwise people think, oh, it's okay. Like amongst the, I mean, we have a, I don't know about your language, but in our language we have kiam, a word that says kiam. Like, let it go, it's okay. Just kiam, like, just forget about it. But the elders tell us now no more. We can't say that anymore. We can't go kiam anymore because it's hurting our people. It's hurting our young people. The young people now are having a hard time making a distinction between the people that are working with them and the ones that are working against them. Because too many times we have just let it go. And the elders said, no more of that. We can't do that anymore, they said. We have to call out the people now. And so that's what they were saying about 2 months ago. I was at a big elders gathering, and that's what the elders were talking about. They said, no more. We were used to, they were saying, you know, in Christianity, when we're in residential school, everybody says, oh, we weren't affected by well, we were affected by it, but we got over it. No, we didn't get over it because they tell you to turn the other cheek. That's not us. That's not our people. It wasn't like that. Because people had to remember that you have taken care of the future. And if someone was destroying the future, they had broken one of the biggest laws amongst our people. You cannot violate the future. And you, when you destroy the future, you don't have the right to do that. And there's a punishment for it. And we don't talk about that. But, you know, because Christianity says, oh, love everybody and be nice and all that sort of stuff, you know. But the elders said, no more. You can't do that. So I call out people now. You know, you sold us out. And you're continuing to sell us out. And people don't like it, but they have to prove to me that they're not doing it, because they have to prove to the future generations they're not doing it. And I'll call them out for the future generations and say, you're doing this against my grandchildren, my great-grandchildren, and my great-great-grandchildren. And I have a right to say that because I'm the woman. And I'm the one that owns the land. And even now, people think women don't own our land. We own the land. That's why we have clan mothers. We're the ones that own the land. Men never owned land because they didn't know how to take care of it. It was the women that were the one in that relationship. We're the ones that give birth. We're the ones that have the ownership. That's why when we made treaty, our women never touched the treaty. And people say, oh, well, the reason that your women didn't touch the treaty was because you didn't have the capacity to touch treaties. Because that was men's work. Nah. That's what I say. The reason we didn't touch the treaty was because it was not about land. And the elders said, are you trying to get after our land? And they said, no. We don't want your land. We can't buy your land. We don't have enough money to buy your land. We want peace and friendship. Oh, well, peace and friendship, that's men's work. They make war, they make peace, they can be friendly. And so the women sat back and said, okay, well, you know, go for it. Go ahead, make the peace and friendship treaty. We're just hanging back here watching the whole thing. So, you know, we know that that these are not land surrender treaties because the women never touched the treaty. And so that's what young women, our young women that I talk to, I tell them that. You know, women are very, very powerful. That's why I cannot understand why people say that Indian women want to be equal to Indian men. I cannot understand that concept. Why do we want to be equal to Indian men? Why would I come from my position as a woman here to be down there with the men? I'm telling you, I am not nuts. I am not prepared to do that. I remember one time a chief, he said to me, oh, he's in town. I said, oh, yeah. Yeah, he said, I heard some people talking. I said, yeah, he said, I heard that you Indian women wanted to be equal to us men. I said, take it easy, you know. Don't get crazy on me. I said, why would I want to be equal to you men? I don't want to come down there with you guys. Yeah, he said, I kind of thought that too, he said, but I just thought I'd ask. I said, yeah, it's okay, it's good to ask questions, you know, but don't get carried away with it, you know. So, but our, you know, if you look at the declaration, it says they amended it. And it says Indian men and women are equal. And I read that and I thought, whose harebrained idea was this to put that in there? You know, that's a white concept. That's a non-indigenous concept. That's, you know, that's why you have, you know, these things that are happening to our women now, that these men are taught these things about the women and they think they can abuse them. You know, and that's, you know, that's got to stop. And being equal is not the way to do it. Because it alienates us from our relationship with the mother that we have. You know, because the woman was the one that created life. Who was the one that sat on the turtle to make the turtle island? It wasn't a man, it was a woman. You know. Who was the one that worked with the clans? It was the women. So, I don't know where people get the idea that on Turtle Island that they're equal to men and women. I don't know where that came from. It's kind of a dumb idea, I think. I don't accept it. So that's a, you know, that's the kind of work that goes on at the UN. And, you know, like we're constantly trying to put our position forward without losing who we are. Because there's tremendous pressure on us. To say, yeah, okay, that's all right, you know, like, we'll go along with that. PM, as I said earlier, the elders have always said no, nor have in the past have, you know, done that, but now they're saying no, and at the UN we've never done that. We've never, well, at least I haven't. Some other people have been okay, they're good with it, but then they're not having to live into the future, are they? So, we have to really understand who we are and fight from that position. Well, I'm just looking out the window here. I'm sitting in Thunder Bay looking out the window at that beautiful mountain over there. And knowing that there's a story behind that mountain. And it would be really nice to know what that story is and what the mountain what it's called in its own language. It has its name. And we need to start putting our names back on our places, and putting our names back on rivers and different pieces of the land. And because people, like, I'll give you an example. In Alberta, not that I like the name Alberta, but I always call it Oilberta. There's a place called Harry Hill. And originally, in the Cree language, the area was called the Harry Hills. And the reason they used to call it the Harry Hills in our language was because long time ago when the buffalo were, you know, in the millions, they used to come off the high plains because of there was no trees or any kind of winter shelter. And they used to come into that area because it was close to a lot of hay, little hills, trees. It was good shelter, you know, and they'd calve the little buffalo calves in the spring there. And also in the spring, they would lose all their winter coat there. And so the hills were covered with hair. So they called it the Harry Hills. And so then now there's a little town called Harry Hill. So I talk to people and say, oh, do you know why this place is called Harry Hill, or the Harry Hills? And because the buffalo are not there anymore, they didn't know why. So I take the opportunity to explain to them about how much buffalo there was there. And all these hills were covered with buffalo hair from the spring when they were losing their winter coat. And so you can learn so much about who you are and so much about your territory when you're using your language, and you put your language back on the land, and the name of the river, the name of the lake, the name of this, you know, this place, then you can use it to teach the story about your territory, so that the young person learning their language has a connection, you know, with who they are. So like me, I travel all over the world. Like, I've been, you know, all over the world, literally all over the world. But I always know where I'm from. I know my territory. So even if I'm somewhere else teaching in Australia or New Zealand or Europe or wherever I am, South America, Central America, it doesn't matter where I am, I always know where I'm from. You know, and I can be there, and I can sit down, I can close my eyes, and I can pray to the spirits of that place that I'm from to help me with whatever I'm doing, because the spirits travel all over. And the spirit of that name means something, because that connects back to the creation. So I'm never really away from my territory. I'm always there, because the spirits are always with me. And so when you connect your language to your place into the future, your young people will always know where they're from. Even if they're not physically there, they're always spiritually there. And that's where, like, one of the First Nations in Alberta, they're trying to retain language. And one of the things that the elders had decided was that every child that's born will have its own Indian name. So the name, as soon as that child is born, that elder goes right to the hospital or wherever the child is born, at home, wherever, and gives that child its Indian name. And before they put that child's name in the list of who their members are, they put down their Indian name first. Then they put down their white name. So that child always knows right from the time that they breathe in on Mother Earth where they come from. So we need to do that. Like, so many, I see so many of our young people, they don't have their own names. They don't have a name. They need to have a name. Like, even how our children are raised, like, to put the placenta and to put the umbilical cord on, And I know the old people, they always say, you know, they're seeing some child running around, like, you know, they play and they're looking at all these cupboards and they're climbing up and they're looking here and everything. And the elders will say, oh, no, someone didn't take care of this child. They didn't put their umbilical cord away. That's what they're looking for. It wasn't properly handled. That's what they're looking for. And they're looking everywhere for it. Because they know, because they come from the spirit world and they've got certain knowledge. They may not be able to articulate what that knowledge is, but they come with that knowledge that they're supposed to be treated in a certain way. And we need to use our language to connect them to that, who they are. And we need to do that right from the time that they breathe their first breath till the time they breathe their last breath here. That's, you know, that's how we connect with the land. And so, you know, if you don't treat the children the right way, you know, you can't really blame them in the future. People say, oh, look at those young people, the way they're acting. And I say, well, you know, what have they been taught? What do they know? Like when my son reached puberty and he went through the puberty ceremonies, I said, okay, you are a young adult now. I said, you are not a youth. I said, that's not our concept. That's a white man's concept. You're not a white man, you're an indigenous person. I said, now you are a young man. I said, you are to be treat me in a certain way, I will treat you in a certain way. I said, one thing, you have to be respectful. I said, you respect me, I respect you. I said, you be honest, you have courage, you have wisdom. You do all these things, you'll be okay. He's, you know, he's 29 years old. I've never raised my voice to him. He's never raised his voice to me. You know, and I've always treated him with respect. He's always treated me with respect. But I told him right then, I said, don't, you're not going to be like these white kids, you know, who think they can do anything they want. You have to follow the laws of the creation. And now, you know, he tells young people, you know, what you're doing is, don't talk like that to your parents. That's not respectful. Like he himself is doing that because he was raised with respect. You know. And so we have to do that if we're going to show young people, and you just don't say be respectful and then you're disrespectful to other people. You have to live that. And when they see you living that, then they can learn how to do that. And if they don't see that, how can they learn? You know, and on indigenous peoples, I think we learn differently than white people, I have to tell you honestly. Because we watch how people do things. You know? Like, I remember one time I was teaching a class on something, and I decided, I was working with some young people, like 13, 14, 15 year olds. And I was going to teach them something, I can't remember what the lesson was right now, but I asked if they could bring rabbits to school. Somebody to bring me some rabbits. And so they brought rabbits, you know. And so they brought them, you know. I told them not to clean them. I said, well, clean them in the class. We're doing something, some lesson. And so we're cleaning rabbits and talking. The elders were talking and telling stories. And what I wanted the students to learn was, I guess that's what the story was I wanted them to learn that doing everyday things, they can learn something. And so we talked about the story about how come the rabbit is brown. How did the rabbit get brown? And I remember I told a story when my son was a baby about the rabbit playing with the sun, shooting an arrow into the sun, and then because he didn't like the sun creeping up, or jumping up out of the sky, you know, jumping up. And then he would scare the rabbit, and so the rabbit shot him. And then now he kind of rises up to look where the rabbit is. That's how he comes to slowly sunrise. And the students didn't know the story. Our rabbit is brown. And so I thought, okay, let's do some elders training and let them tell stories about rabbits as they're cleaning them. Right? And so doing everyday things, and they're watching and they're listening, they're learning two things. They're learning a little bit about how to clean rabbits, cook rabbits, eat rabbits, but the relationship that we have with the rabbit and what that rabbit, what his role in the creation is. So there's a number of things going on at the same time, and we don't compartmentalize our learning. Like, we don't say, okay, now we're doing history, and, you know, now we're going to do science, and then now we're going to do math, or now we're going to do something else. We tend to do it in a different kind of way. And I remember when I first started going to college, I was very bad in English, really bad. I had never written an essay in my whole entire life. I didn't know what. And I remember going up to one of the professors. Now I think about how dumb it was. But anyway, I went up to this professor and I said to him, can you show me how to write an essay? And he said, what? I said, can you show me how to write an essay? And he said, what do you mean? And I said, well, how do you write an essay? He said, just show me and I'll watch you. And he couldn't understand what I was trying to do, and I couldn't understand how I could learn how to write an essay unless somebody showed me how to do it. And I wanted him to show me, like, how you make bread or how you sew something, or I wanted to see someone doing it so I could copy it. And he didn't teach things like that. So we learn. I'm convinced that because of our language and the way we learn things around us, the way we learn is also different. And it's quite a fundamental difference between the learning styles. And that's what, you know, I think the way that they're approaching teaching language in universities is wrong. Because they're teaching to teach the language in a white way of thinking about language. Rather than language, like, there was a big, we got into a big scrap out west about the Cree language because the syllabics, we have syllabics, and that was given to us through the creation. And there's a story behind how the syllabics came into being. But these people in the language classes decided that it didn't, for them it didn't make sense, so they wanted to rearrange the syllabics, like make it A, B, C, D, rather than the way it was with the story. And they wanted to rearrange it, and we were saying, you can't rearrange that. That came from the creation. You can't do that. Like, what are you trying to do? You're trying to make our language into, like, a white way of looking at it. You know, and we can't do that. We have to maintain the integrity of the language, because you don't rearrange the land, although they try to do rearrange the land, to suit us. We live with the land. Same thing when we live with our language. And that's what it does, you know. So that's why I think, you know, these two things are interconnected, which is why they don't want us to learn our language, I think, because they're trying to separate us from the land. And that's why it's important that we do learn the language, and we pass on that information to our young people, because that'll give them the courage, that'll give them the wisdom to carry on into the future, because that gives them a gift that can never be taken away from them, and connects them directly to who they are in their territory. No matter where they travel in the world, they'll always have that inside of them. I think that's why it's important.
Nothing British is a campaign against racism and extremism. Add your voice by signing our petition at www.nothingbritish.com.
तपाईलाई थाहा छ नेपालमा पहिलो पटक कहिले एचआईभी संक्रमित व्यक्ति फेला परेको थियो
थाहा छ सन 1988 मा
यतिका वर्ष बितिसक्दा एचआईभी एड्स को क्षेत्रमा के भए सकारात्मक परिवर्तनहरू कति आए कसले के गरे
के हामीले आफ्नो जिम्मेवारी बहन गर्यौं तपाईले गर्नुभयो
जवाफ आफैसँग खोजौं जिम्मेवारी बहन गरौं
सामाजिक रूपान्तरणका लागि गगन गृहको एउटा प्रयास
Don't let the colonial occupation blues get you down. Listen to the Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. The podcast for Intelligent Aboriginals.